It's philosophy talk.
Hey, nani, nani, talking. Hey, nani, nani.
Othello, Shylock, Caliban.
Do Shakespeare's plays reveal the prejudices of his time?
Or do they reinforce those prejudices?
Oh, this play does seem dope to me, Martensia.
Verily, Lashania, verily!
Was Shakespeare peddling in negative stereotypes, or was he challenging them?
Tis about time Shakespeare doth scriven the play that places a brother amongst the firmament.
Woo!
What does it mean to be an outsider in Shakespeare's plays?
Ideal white characters versus less than ideal.
Our guest is David Sterling Brown, author of Shakespeare's White Others.
With white otherness, it's not just a figure like Othello that has to negotiate what I call the intra-racial color line.
Methinks things are looking up for people of the darker hue.
Damn straight!
Shakespeare's Outsiders. Coming up on Philosophy Talk. How does Shakespeare deal with race, gender, and disability?
Do his plays reveal deep truths about identity and status?
Or are they just old-timey soap operas?
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs.
And I'm Adrian Dobbs, sitting in for Josh Landy. We're coming to you from the Stanford Humanities Center.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner, where I teach philosophy and Adrian teaches comparative literature. Adrian's been a guest on the show many times, and I'm very grateful that today he's stepping in as co-host.
My pleasure, and many thanks to the Humanities Center for sponsoring today's event.
Welcome everyone to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Shakespeare's outsiders.
You know, Ray, I find Shakespeare's outsiders more interesting than his heroes, right? If you think of Othello, Shylock, Caliban.
I don't know. I think that Shakespeare is really unfair to those characters. Look, Othello is violent and jealous. Shylock is vengeful and greedy. Caliban is primitive and mean. These guys are basically racist stereotypes.
Okay, now I think you're being a little unfair to Shakespeare. Audiences have a ton of empathy for these characters. There's a reason they're iconic, right? How many people remember King Henry VI? He's pretty boring in comparison.
Oh yeah, they're memorable, all right, but I wouldn't say they're exactly sympathetic. I mean, I wouldn't want to be remembered as the most bloodthirsty and evil person in my department.
Okay, so full disclosure, I've been described that way, and I take offense, but look, more seriously, an interesting play requires drama. We do like our anti-heroes, and who'd want to see a play where good people do good things and then get praised for it?
Look, I'm not complaining that they're insufficiently nice. I am complaining that they're stereotypes. Look, Macbeth is a horrible homicidal maniac, but it's not because he's Scottish. Yeah, he's very flawed, but he still gets to be a whole person.
Well, perhaps Shylock isn't as stereotypical as you think. Has he not eyes, hands? If you prick him, does he not bleed? Shakespeare isn't just recycling the prejudices of his time. He's reflecting on them, and he makes you empathize with someone like Shylock, which, you know, last time I checked, is not the most bigoted thing to do.
Oh, okay, so Shakespeare makes you empathize with Shylock, but he's still basically a stereotype of a greedy Jew. Giving your anti-Semitic stereotype feelings doesn't really absolve you of the anti-Semitism.
Okay, I'll agree with Shylock, but he's just one character out of, what, 1,223, give or take a herald?
So what, Shakespeare has great Jewish representation in his other plays? What do we have, Rosenberg and Guildenstein? Do we have two gentlemen of Brooklyn?
Okay, but he's maybe not thinking about difference in exactly the same terms we are today. It's maybe not just black and white, Jewish versus Christian, male versus female. It's about all kinds of diversity.
Oh, yeah, I forgot his really sensitive disability representation in Richard III. The guy who's so deformed that dogs bark at me as I halt by them, who decides to be a villain because of that. It's just another terrible stereotype. How is it any different from the comic book trope of the guy who is missing a hand and is therefore the evil one?
Okay, but counterexample, Shakespeare is pretty sensitive in his treatment of mental illness. Hamlet and King Lear are tragic heroes, right? They're at the center of their own story. Shakespeare takes tons of time exploring their psychology in real depth, and he never really asks the audience to judge them.
Yeah, but the audience does judge them. Hamlet's tortured inner life results in this huge body count, and Lear's madness destroys his whole family. These guys are not role models.
Okay, but why do they have to be role models? People weren't going to the Globe to learn how to behave. They were going to have a good time, to be entertained.
Oh, come on. It's just not just entertainment. It's serious art. It is literally Shakespearean tragedy.
Okay, that just proves my point. Tragedy is about that. It's about flawed individuals making a gigantic mess of things. It's not about nice people doing reasonable things for 3 hours.
Yeah, but audiences still learn things from the entertainment they're consuming. And Shakespeare was teaching his audiences to have bigoted attitudes.
Okay, so I'd wager that they were already bigoted. They probably came in with a bunch of simplistic stereotypes, and at best, Shakespeare was able to give them nuanced characters and complex storylines that complicated those.
I feel like nuanced and complex bigotry is still problematic.
Well, maybe our guest will change your mind. It's David Sterling Brown, author of Shakespeare's White Others, and he'll be joining us shortly.
But first, since we've only been talking about Shakespeare's male characters so far, how did he think about female characters? We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to find out. She files this report.
All that is great in me might be made little by a word, but I will spin you a tale that brings you in again. For every oar...
That's Nell's Ode by poet Elizabeth Sylvia from her collection None But Witches, Poems on Shakespeare's Women. It's inspired by the character Nell from Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors.
I am swart as the earth's crust, soot as the banked embers.
Nell, a kitchen maid, is married to one of a pair of twins separated at birth. She mistakes the twin she's not married to for her husband.
He thinks he's been, like, trapped by witchcraft, and he and his boss, who is also a secret twin, by the way, do a 3-page takedown of Nell.
Nell is never even on stage.
She's fat, she's sweaty, she's smelly, she's dark. They compare her to a globe and her body parts to various countries.
Sylvia's poem is a response on Nell's behalf.
As if you ever could stop burying in me desires that I raise in you.
In Sylvia's collection, published by 3 Mile Harbor Press, the women of Shakespeare unleashed their pain, sorrow, and might. The project emerged after Sylvia made a New Year's resolution to read all of Shakespeare's plays in a year. For the record, it took 2. Just a few plays in, she was pretty disturbed.
Like, I was just so angry at what was happening to the female characters, especially in these early plays, which a lot of people don't read, are really, they're just super violent anyway, but they're particularly violent towards women, I think.
Die, die, Lavinia, and thy shame with thee.
What hast thou done? Unnatural and unkind.
Sylvia thinks mothers in Shakespeare have it especially bad.
I'm seeing play after play after play in which if you have a kid, that kid is killed, and you spend the rest of the play like basically walking back and forth in the at the back of the stage hoping someone will pay attention to you as you try to express how completely destroyed you've been by this death.
But you can scrutinize how Shakespeare portrays people and still appreciate his work. To love Shakespeare is to know him, argues Farah Kareem Cooper, a professor of Shakespeare Studies at King's College London and co-director of education at Shakespeare's Globe.
In order for us to keep Shakespeare around, he's got to be more accessible. Otherwise, he's going to become obsolete.
Kareem Cooper says if we shy away from the flaws in Shakespeare, his work becomes hard to relate to. That's part of why she started the Globe's Shakespeare and Race Festival in 2018. The festival brings together actors and academics to talk about race in Shakespeare.
There was a lot of bewilderment on the part of the public because nobody had really had a public conversation about Shakespeare and race.
She faced a lot of backlash.
You have people constantly accusing you of just doing it for tokenism or that it's driven by your own identity or that it doesn't have any real validity or we're trying to cancel Shakespeare. So that makes it difficult. And that is backlash to the Black Lives Matter movement.
Kareem Cooper wants to keep Shakespeare in schools and in the imagination, but she says we should do so without blind worship. Like the poet Elizabeth Sylvia, who saw value in reading all of Shakespeare's plays.
Run into the marketplace with me, mothers of this world, for I have seen you weeping at the dry-edged river and wading from the boats.
Her poem Unbind is inspired by Constance from Shakespeare's play King John. Constance's son has been abducted, but the male characters keep asking her to fix her hair. Shakespeare may be onto the idea of tone policing.
Because our hair makes fire of the wind, and all around us, knots are come undone, and birth instead of death is thundering.
As a person in the contemporary world, Sylvia says, it can seem like the world is crashing down around you. But the women of Shakespeare never seem to give up in any circumstance. They're powerful.
If I be waspish, best beware my sting.
The Shakespearean world, like ours, is just a mess. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly Timmick-Deed.
Thank you for that revealing report, Holly. I'm Ray Briggs, along with my Stanford colleague, Adrian Daub, who's sitting in for Josh Landy. And we're at the Stanford Humanities Center, who has generously sponsored today's event.
Our guest today is professor of English at Trinity College in Hartford. He's also the author of the recent book, Shakespeare's White Others. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, David Sterling Brown. So David, you've written about how Shakespeare treats characters who are outsiders in some way. What in your own experience drew you to these outsider figures?
Yeah, I'd have to say it started with adolescence, really. Looking back to that, I was writing this book and thinking about how there were times when I, as sometimes the lone black student in my middle school, high school scenarios, was the outsider. But then also seeing how even some of my peers who didn't look like me were also outsiders. So I just became fascinated by that.
So David, Shakespeare is a lot of things to a lot of people. He's art, he's entertainment. What do we gain by looking at him through a racial lens?
We gain a lot. I mean, we gain an understanding of our modern world, first and foremost. We can also see the continuity between then and now, and thinking about how even modern stereotypes that we have were sort of at play in Shakespeare's world, or at least anticipating where we are today. And so there's a lot that can be looked at through Shakespeare's plays that allows us to, again, map onto the now solutions for even problems that we have in our modern world.
So how was race different for Shakespeare than it is for us?
Well, one thing to note, race in Shakespeare's period actually did not mean what it means today. It actually meant family, kin, for instance. And so as time evolved and as definitions evolved, right, we start to see, you know, there is resonance between this idea of connectivity between people of a certain group or subset that allows us to think about how race in Shakespeare's time is in some ways similar to how we think about it today. Of course, race is not a biological factor. It is a social construct, but we use it to organize in our social settings and groups in our modern world.
Yeah, and what continuities do you see between sort of our contemporary concept of race and what was going on in Shakespeare?
Sure. Well, certainly the valuation of whiteness, for instance, racial whiteness, but also the devaluation of blackness. So within Shakespeare's plays, you know, Othello is mentioned. That's a play where we can see clearly how anti-blackness was something that was prevalent in the early modern culture. We can also see how the value of whiteness gets praised in certain plays. So that's one example to think about in response to your question.
Yeah, so one thing you say in your book is that this is a time of like race formation when the concepts of black and white were sort of coalescing into what they are now. Have I got that right?
Yes. I mean, I do mention medieval literature because thinking about Geraldine Hang, who's a scholar, her work, she also talks about it in the medieval period. And so it moves forward, though.
And did Shakespeare reflect this, or did the theater have a real hand in shaping people's attitudes?
I think it's a bit of both, right? When we think about how in Shakespeare's day there were no, as far as we know, black actors on the stage. So the fact that you have people blacking up and using blackface on the stage, that's one way to think about it. But also, even just considering how whiteness is important in Shakespeare's plays, thinking about plays like Hamlet or Much Ado About Nothing, we start to see the usages of terms like fair, for instance, that have a lot of capital in those plays and shape Shakespeare's world, but also shape ours. So it's interesting to look back and read and see that.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about Shakespeare's Outsiders with David Sterling Brown from Trinity College, Hartford.
What's your favorite Shakespeare play? Do you ever worry about his politics, or do you like the way he makes you root for the underdog?
Much gavalt about nothing? Along with questions from our live audience, when Philosophy Talk continues. Do Shakespeare's characters get put down and pushed around because of their race, gender, or disability? I'm Ray Briggs, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Adrian Dobbs, sitting in for Josh Landy. Our guest is David Sterling Brown from Trinity College, and we're thinking about Shakespeare's Outsiders. Special thanks to the Stanford Humanities Center for sponsoring today's episode.
Got a comment or question about identity in Shakespeare's plays? Join the discussion by raising your hand. And Laura will put you on the list and bring the mic to you when it's your turn to talk.
So David, a lot of people think about race as black versus white, but your work on Shakespeare specifically explores the tensions between white people. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so in the book, I'm first of all identifying this figure of the white other, who is this less than ideal white character that appears in the play. And I'm doing that along signs of the what I call the intra-racial color line. So thinking about white-on-white dynamics, ideal white characters versus less than ideal, and how there's sort of these in-group and out-group dynamics that form in Shakespeare's plays.
So if you're like a good white character for Shakespeare, what is that consistent? What do you do?
Oh, I love that question. So you are, you know, you're morally good, you're ethically good, you are also somebody who adheres to the standards of the dominant culture, whatever they might be, and they do shift at times. And so I would say that's the sort of basic criteria for being a good white character in Shakespeare's plays.
That's like not a lot of his characters, I'm noticing.
Yes, you know, there are ways in which these characters shift in and out of that space of being an ideal figure versus a less than ideal figure. For instance, like Macbeth is actually a really good example of that.
Yeah, tell me more about Macbeth. Like, when is he good? When is he bad? How does that work?
So Macbeth is good at the beginning of the play before he decides to have his king over and host him and kill him. So there's that, you know, turns him into a sinner. He violates hospitality code, right, which is super important in the early modern period. And his wife is also implicated in that, but he kills other people in the play too. And so when we think about sin, when we think about the moral nature of his character as well as ethically, he is sort of blackened in that play and even referred to as Black Macbeth in the lines of the play by Malcolm.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious about the color imagery that you kind of, you find all of this imagery in Shakespeare equating sort of fair or which sort of means pale and also beautiful and mm-hmm. also good, and then sort of, on the other hand, black with, like, bad and evil and not beautiful. How do I think about these terms getting, like, stuck together, getting all these meanings stuck together? Like, is it happening before Shakespeare? Is it happening, like, when Shakespeare is writing?
I mean, so we can think about this as even going back to the Bible, right, where you have color symbolism being managed in that text. But of course, as I mentioned, medieval literature. But so it predates Shakespeare in terms of the color symbolism. I'm less invested in that so much as I am in thinking about even what we can't see in these characters, right? So moral, like I said, moral qualities, ethics, but even clothing can be a determining factor in how we can perceive a character as a white other or not.
So one of the things that you kind of draw on is this idea that this is really much about a process and about is a dynamic thing. People are not sort of statically slotted into, you know, white other or not white other, right? Macbeth moves kind of in the wrong direction, quote unquote, as the play goes on.
Yeah.
And which, of course, is kind of different from the way that it comes sort of race comes to be conceptualized in, let's say, the 18th century or something like that. I'm wondering, like, one of the things that's really noticeable about the book is that it's not sort of a question of, like, where these characters fall ethnically. So, for instance, someone like Cleopatra, who, like, we might historically think, like, oh, yeah, well, that's the person who obviously wouldn't have looked like a British person, most likely. I mean, we can't
find that out, but it seems likely. Mm-hmm. That's not how you position her. It's not the fact that she ethnically might have registered differently. No, it's about how she falls into the moral economy of the play, right? Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, so in that play, just make sure I understand you correctly. So within Shakespeare's play, like some scholars like Kim F. Hall, for instance, who wrote Things of Darkness, I'm thinking about Cleopatra in the way that Shakespeare positions her as right. black. But in the middle of that play, there's a moment where her hand is referred to as the white hand of a lady.
Right.
And so there we have this turn, and it begs the question of what is the value being placed on her body in terms of whitening her hand when we're seeing her as referred to as tawny, for instance, or blackened, et cetera.
Right, so it's something that people can also sort of get back, it seems like. It's like, you know, the tragedy can move characters in and out of this space that you're describing.
They can move in and out of it, depends now, because in the tragedies, for instance, like Titus Andronicus is a character right. who begins on the right side of the interracial color line, but by the end of that, he is just as barbaric as the Goths and Aaron the Moor. I think a more fitting character is like Hero from Much Ado About Nothing.
Right, yes. Hero, if I'm remembering right, is engaged to Claudio. Mm-hmm. And then Claudio sort of gets told some kind of rumor that yes. she's not sexually pure.
Yes.
And this, like, impurifies her, and he's, like, super upset about it.
Yes.
And then there's kind of an interesting subplot, right, where there's a maid who gets... tell me about the subplot.
Yeah, so there's an interesting moment. So the reason I bring up Hero, right, is that when that moment that you're talking about happens, when she's accused of being a whore, her father says that she has fallen into a pit of ink. And so if we just slow down and think about that moment as this white woman figure emerging from a pit of ink, because she doesn't actually die in the play, it's a comedy, so these characters don't die, she's essentially an invisible blackened woman, right? And so there's the stereotype of hypersexuality that's being played upon there in that moment. And she does go away in the play, but she comes back once it's realized that she's not actually impure, and she gets to marry Claudio.
So I want to ask more about Hero, because there's this thing that happens in the middle, right? So if I'm remembering, like, some powerful guy wants to have sex with Hero. And the way that she gets out of it is by substituting her maid, who wants to have sex with the powerful guy.
Okay, so yeah, in the play, there's the sort of ruse, yes, and the sex doesn't actually happen, but it's perceived to be Hero, and that's why it's thought that she is a whore. And so that's how she ends up being blackened and falling into this pit of ink.
I'm curious about the maid. Like, what should we think about her and her status?
Well, she's a lower class character in the play, right? So there's that. And I guess in terms of thinking about morals and ethics, being in on this ruse obviously disturbs things in the play in terms of thinking about white otherness. But class is not necessarily something that makes one a white other, which is interesting. Like, Hamlet is a figure that I think about as a white other as well, and he's a royal figure.
Right, so it's more about sort of doing the moral thing that is your station correctly.
Could be, but it could also be, so in Hamlet, for instance, it's not really Hamlet's morality that makes him, or immorality that makes him a white other, it's the way that he's perceived as not being manly, for instance. So he's referred to as having unmanly grief by Claudio. But then also there's these moments in the play where he's referring to himself even as being, like, effeminate and not man enough. And so the ideal standards of early modern culture would go against that in terms of thinking about ideal masculinity.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, and we're at the Stanford Humanities Center thinking about Shakespeare's Outsiders with David Sterling Brown, author of Shakespeare's White Others. And we have a question from our live audience.
Hi, I'm David from Menlo Park. So my question is it clear that this imagery about whiteness and darkness, fairness and dirtiness and so forth, is it clear that there's a connection, a nexus between that and our modern notions of race?
Yes. You know, we can see in Shakespeare's plays, right, how I'm thinking about a figure like Aaron the Moor from Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, for instance. He's Shakespeare's first black character, and Titus is my favorite tragedy. But even in that play, you have this division between the Goths, the Romans, and the Moors. There's a baby that appears later in the play, so I put the plural there. But we can see how these groupings function in that society in very similar ways to our own. And as these outsiders, the Goths, come in, you know, they are very much treated like enemies because they are prisoners of war. But then we also see slippage there with the character Tamara, who's a Goth. She becomes Empress of Rome, right? So she gets this elevation in that moment in the play, and then slowly the play works itself to eradicate these less than ideal white characters once it's realized that they can never really be as good as the sort of pure characters in the play that are typically the Roman figures. But there are other Goths that are not bad in the play, so it gets complicated. But yes, we do see that continuity. And I think Titus is a really great play. Othello's another play where we can kind of see this mapped out too easily.
So we've got another question from our live audience. Hi, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Guy from Woodside. I'm getting lost a little bit in your term other. And I was wondering, if I missed the definition, could you please repeat it? It seems elastic to me right now.
Sure. So I'm thinking about, with respect to the white other, I'm thinking about how within whiteness there are divisions. So one of the things that's important to sort of understand the concepts of my book, and Titus again is another play that makes it really easy to see it when you look at my chapter in the book, I'm taking Aaron out of it for a moment, because even in the first 600 lines of that play, it's a character who doesn't say anything. So we're just watching dynamics between the white characters in that moment. And it's pretty clear how Shakespeare shows us that with white otherness, these characters who are less than ideal, they do not meet the standards of the dominant culture for whatever reason, because the dominant culture is what defines what the standards are. And so as we see these characters sort of assimilate, right, Tamara is able to become Empress of Rome because she is adopted, you know, happily into Rome in that play. And that allows us, again, to see with these divisions that it's porous, just like I think about the concept of racial passing, for instance, back in, you know, times, postbellum period, for instance, there were people who were considered black, right, that could pass as white. And so they weren't necessarily deemed or seen as other, even though they may have known that they were. And I think that's a more sort of modern connection to understanding this concept of white otherness that I'm thinking about.
I'm also wondering, so you're mostly talking about the tragedies in the book, but we've sort of veered into the comedy a little bit. And one thing that I'm noticing as you're describing these characters is that they sort of come by negotiating this internal color line pretty honestly. That is to say, they don't tend to perform their way across it. A lot of people in Shakespeare dress up as other things, but that's something else. That seems to be not what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, it's not a performance. But I love that you said negotiating, because that's the title of my introduction, is Negotiating Whiteness. And I use a quotation from a play that Claudia Rankine has called Help, where she says, "This is why, to stay alive, forget thriving, I need to negotiate whiteness." And what we see in these plays is that it's not just a figure like Othello, right, or Aaron that has to negotiate whiteness. It's all of these characters, because they live in a white-dominated world. And what I want people to understand through the concept of the white other and the interracial color line is how whiteness is not invisible. I mean, we live in a world where people often think if blackness isn't present, then race doesn't exist. And so I want to, again, sort of other whiteness, to get people to see that we should always be thinking about race, and that we can, even in the absence of blackness.
So I'm kind of curious about this idea of like a precarious status, which it seems like white otherness is. So there's the, you are safely inside whatever power exists, and you can stop worrying about it, which is, I think, one way of being powerful. And then there is the, you are sort of inside whatever power exists until you do the wrong thing, and then you're not there anymore. Mm-hmm. And white otherness seems very much about sort of the precarious sort of inside power.
Yeah. I mean, I think to go back to my sort of adolescent image, right, to be in the in-group, you've kind of got to conform on some level, because you can be in today and out tomorrow. And I think it really depends on your behavior, right, and how you are adhering to the standards of what the in-group, or, you know, thinking back to middle school, what do the popular kids think is cool, right? Or what do they think is defining the circle? And as long as you commit to that, then you're safe. But if you violate those norms, and I think that's what these characters do, like, again, Macbeth, he violates social code, he violates norms. That gets him put on the wrong side of the interracial color line.
How do I know when the norms are about race and when they're about something else? Or is that a sensible question to ask? Because it seems like in your Hamlet example, both race and masculinity are very important. Mm-hmm. Do you think that like there's any sense in trying to separate that those out? Or is it just one like mess of power?
I mean, short answer is it's messy. I mean, I think race is always messy when we have conversations about it. But you can't take race out of the equation, right? Just like you can't take gender out of the equation. Everyone has a racial makeup. Everyone has a gender identity. And so I'm really interested in tracking how that operates in these plays and thinking about intersectionality in particular. How race, gender, and class, all those things are working together in our modern world always. And they're also working together in these plays. Like, I can't look at Hero and not see that she's a woman and say that her gender matters in terms of how she's being treated in that moment.
Is there an element, though? I mean, like, are there moments when we, I mean, I take your point that these two are always intertwined, but with something like, right, part of Macbeth's problem is clearly that in his household, the gendered roles are maybe a little misdistributed. That mm-hmm. seems to be what does poor Duncan in. Is that just the fact that like he's not wearing the pants in the relationship? Is that the kind of dynamic you're describing, or would that sort of very safely just fall into a gender bucket basically?
No. So I love that you asked that question because I think about the Macbeths in the book. And Lady Macbeth is a character who embodies masculine qualities, right? She's actually more masculine, I'd say, than her husband.
Yeah.
And she even critiques his inept masculinity. And it's that inversion, actually, that leads to the contribution of their white otherness and how we can see that. Because Lady Macbeth does not meet the standards of the ideal white woman in that play. And Macbeth certainly does not meet the standards of the ideal white man. And then once we sort of track their trajectories, and again, I just love that Black Macbeth line, Black Macbeth will seem as pure as snow, right? He will seem that, as Malcolm says, but he's not. He's not as pure as snow. And so there's a call to attention there about how Macbeth, inside, he is impure. It's about his soul. It's about his spirit. It's about his moral character.
So I want to ask a little bit more about precarity and about conduct. So it seems like things have kind of significantly changed between when Shakespeare was writing and now, in the sense that like if you're white now, you might get kicked out of whiteness if the racial lines shift due to like factors that are beyond your control. But I'm not sure that you can like misconduct yourself out of whiteness in the same way, or do you think that's right?
Well, so the white other, if I'm understanding you correctly, is still white, but they're othered, right? Mm-hmm. So one example that I call attention to in the book, in chapter 4, I believe, I'm thinking about, Jerry Sandusky, this beloved football, figure, but then there's a situation, a scandal, that leads to a sort of backlash in terms of how he was, idealized and thought about. And a lot of that has to do with, again, the undeniability of this violation, right? And so he's still a white man, right? But in terms of his status as a white man, that has changed. And he's no longer seems to be revered in the same way that a figure like Macbeth, for instance, is certainly not revered in that play, or Iago is not a revered figure in that play for the things that he does to Othello and the other characters.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Shakespeare's Outsiders with David Sterling Brown from Trinity College Hartford, author of Shakespeare's White Others.
Is Shakespeare education or just entertainment? Why are his plots so over the top? Could soap operas be the modern day Shakespeare?
We're coming to you from the Stanford Humanities Center, who've generously sponsored today's event. We'll take more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Yeah, we're all big stars.
If all the world's a stage, does that mean we're in a soap opera? I'm Ray Briggs. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Adrian Dobbs, sitting in for Josh Landy. Our guest is David Sterling Brown from Trinity College, and we're at the Stanford Humanities Center thinking about Shakespeare's Outsiders.
So, David, I hear you're a big fan of daytime soap operas, and you think they have something in common with Shakespeare. Can you care to elaborate?
I can, and I feel so embarrassed right now. But yeah, so I'm a big fan of like shows like The Young, the Restless, and The Bold and the Beautiful, and actually a great example of not just because it's entertainment, but I see this concept of, you know, the white other and the interracial color line playing out even in that show. So last week, actually, I watched The Bold and the Beautiful, and a character who we might refer to as the white other, her house gets broken into by a character who we would pitch as like the ideal white woman in the play or in the show, and she gets accosted. So we've got trespassing, we've got her being accosted. There are no consequences for the ideal white woman. It's actually the white other figure, Sheila, who gets pitched as the wrongdoer. And I'm like, where have I seen that before? I mean, we see that play out in our modern world when it comes to even, you know, anti-black state police violence, for instance, how someone can be a victim of that violence even though they're innocent. And I just was fascinated by it. I was laughing hysterically because I'm like, her house got broken into. Like, she's the victim, but she doesn't get to be the victim because she's the outsider in that show.
Yeah, so we have like very similar psychodramas playing out in like the soap opera and in Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Do you think that Shakespeare was like the soap opera of his day? Does that make sense as a comparison?
I kind of like that because, you know, it's entertainment, right? Shakespeare was writing these plays for them to be performed so we could see the language put into action. And I think also, though, the plays are mechanisms for transmitting ideals about the culture. I think we see that in soap operas as well.
I was a little surprised to hear that you make that comparison, but it now makes a lot of sense to me, because I initially thought like one place where it seems to me that the internal color line gets policed a lot today is in reality shows. But of course, what soap operas really share with Shakespeare is this kind of insistence on artifice and reflecting on artifice. What's the role of that, of being like all the world's a stage? Like, this isn't real. What you're seeing is an heightened, idealized, hyper-real version of what's going on outside. What role does that play in it? Both those shows and Shakespeare's plays are so insistent, like, hey guys, remember, this is a play.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the interesting things for me is just, you know, how aspects of identity are performative. Mm-hmm. That's one way that I like to think about a connection. But again, just going back to the way that these shows, or any form of entertainment, it could even be a commercial, they transmit messages to us. And I think that's what I find so valuable about Shakespeare's work. I know a lot of people sort of resist Shakespeare's work or they're afraid of it, but I think it's so rich and I think there's so much in it for us to learn from. And similarly, I used to think that, you know, The Bold and the Beautiful, Young and the Restless were just mindless entertainment, guilty pleasures, but I actually learn things and I see things being reflected back to me even as I think about the critical literature that I study.
So I was definitely brought up to think that Shakespeare and soap operas were supposed to be completely different because Shakespeare is important and educational, whereas soap operas are like mindless entertainment. Where does that idea come from, and should I be getting over it?
I think, you know, first of all, Shakespeare is, you know, referred to as the greatest dramatist that ever lived, so there's a lot of capital that his name carries. But as you were just talking, I was reminded that even sometimes on The Bold and the Beautiful, there are two characters, Ridge Forrester is one of them. He has recited Shakespeare's poetry at times on the show. So, like, this merger of Shakespeare with soap operas is not something that I'm just creating. Like, even the writers do that. And I think that shows both the value of Shakespeare's literature today, but also, again, they're capitalizing on Shakespeare's sort of brand recognition, if you will, right? Because even if somebody hasn't studied Shakespeare, they've likely at least heard that name. You can't really go many places, like New York, for example, You can see subway ads with quotations from Shakespeare and stuff. So it's kind of everywhere in a way.
I also want to come back to the thing you said about moral lessons. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out the sense in which Shakespeare is teaching moral lessons. Like, I don't think of him as somebody who's intending to teach moral lessons, but I guess you could teach a moral lesson without intending it. Like, how much of this is on purpose and how much of it is unconscious, and how do I pull that apart?
I think it's, again, two things can be true, and I think that's probably the answer to the question. So Othello and Desdemona are a good example, and I'm not saying that I agree with how the play plays out for them, but in terms of thinking about the issues that it raises, right, Desdemona marries Othello without her father's consent. So there's a message there being sent about what mattered in the early modern period, about how fathers were supposed to be involved and invested and consulted as sort of marriage intermediaries. There's also an age difference between Othello and Desdemona, and so we're learning something there. They're sort of unequally yoked, if you will. We can take that further and think about our modern world, where people will consider, you know, class dynamics and suggest that somebody maybe shouldn't marry down, so to speak, in terms of class. So all of that is at play in these works. I do think Shakespeare was trying to, of course, reinforce certain ideals from his society, but also teach and undermine them even at times.
Yeah, so your Macbeth example and your Othello example are both person does bad thing, person gets bad consequence. Are there examples that you think don't fall into that mold as well?
In terms of somebody doing something bad and something the consequences for it, or
right? So I'm thinking, like, morality play is a structure where, like, you do a bad thing and it's invariably followed by a bad consequence, and this shows that, like, you never should have done the bad thing. Mm-hmm. You will only suffer. Do you think that that is what the tragedies are about? I don't think it's what the comedies are about. Do you think that that's too simplistic?
I don't think that's too simplistic. I mean, I think any sort of moment of violation has consequences. And I think that's true for us in our today as well.
So in terms of what these plays teach us, right, you've mentioned a couple of things where it's pretty obvious that there is a straightforward moral lesson to be learned here. We shouldn't do X, Y, and Z, right? Like, maybe mourning for too long is not the great idea if you also have a kingdom to kind of be in charge of or whatever. But on the other hand, like, you also describe these things that are, like, hidden in metaphors, that are almost sort of mythologies of racialization, we can mm-hmm. say, right? Like, that someone could easily read the play, view the play a couple of times, and not catch on to. Like, are those on the same level for you? Like, you see what I mean? Like, at what level do these plays teach? Is it, like, there are overt things that they might aim at, but, like, surely, you know, if someone really wants to teach me a lesson, they won't hide it in a metaphor, I would think. Or else, you know, they'll have to hope that I'll watch it 50 times before I'm like, oh, wait, I think this is bad.
It depends, right? Because if I want to impact your unconscious or yeah. send subliminal messages to you, right, because I'm trying to reinforce and constantly reinscribe a certain hierarchy, for instance, I wouldn't necessarily want to make that obvious. And so one of the things that I talk about in the book is how these things are hidden in plain sight. And there's a reason they're hidden in plain sight, because that allows us to maintain the system, if you will.
So that would be something like Desdemona and Othello, where the play never comes out and says, like, you have probably a bad idea for these and those reasons, but, like, you enter the play thinking, ooh, this seems shaky. Yeah. I'm a little worried about these two people.
Yeah, and I mean, and we're supposed to feel that way about them, because Iago, who I analyze in my book's chapter on the play, he's driving that with right. his racist discourse, right? And that does a lot of damage in the play, both on a conscious level, but also unconsciously.
Mm-hmm. So, David, I'm wondering if reflecting on how race works in Shakespeare and how otherness works in Shakespeare should affect how we perform or read Shakespeare today.
Significantly, you know, so I'm hoping people will read the book, because it matters, right? People go, as my colleague Keith Hamilton Cobb likes to say, they go to Broadway, they get their Shakespeare, they go home, and they're happy that they've had their Shakespeare. But if we slow down with these plays and these moments, or one thing that producers will do sometimes is have talkbacks, so they'll talk about the play with the audience, because not everybody's processing all of this, you know, so rapidly in the moment, I think that that can go a long way for making the productions not just entertainment, but learning opportunities.
So, David, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our guest has been David Sterling Brown, professor of English at Trinity College in Hartford, and author of Shakespeare's White Others.
We'll put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and find your muse in our library of nearly 600 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature your question on the blog.
Now, someone who could teach Hamlet a thing or two about getting on with it. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, along with the Beatles, color television, and SUV, Shakespeare is part of the cultural pantheon, a large, unwieldy edifice of all kinds of things, some encrusted, some which drop off like spent mosquitoes from a bloodless dog. Plays in blank verse are no longer made, yet high schools still perform them if they're Shakespeare. Other verse plays, like "'Tis Pity She's a Whore" or "The Jew of Malta," gather dust in the stacks, sadly awaiting the Moms for Liberty proud boy Jack Boots to take away teachers and librarians who might even know these works exist, off to Steve Miller's re-education camp. Once MAGA teams up with politically correct cancel culture, they'll whittle that pantheon down to the size of an Airstream trailer, which is also part of the pantheon, but just barely. But even Shakespeare has work that is problematic, as the kids say. Othello was about a Moor. Moors were Muslims that ran Spain for a while, giving us architecture, Orientalism, and subject matter for half the French painters of the late 19th century. In Shakespeare's time, Moor mainly meant a black person from Africa. In this play, he's also a soldier, just back from conquering Turkey or whatever. He's a hip black warrior, anyway, who's so cool, the white homecoming queen marries him. Iago, his bitter assistant, is a racist psycho who messes with Othello's head, so he winds up killing his wife. It's like a true crime story and investigation discovery, only olden times. I saw this play on the screen in 1964 with Sir Laurence Olivier in blackface. I knew that blackface had existed, of course, but I had not seen the jazz singer. I mean, where would I and why? Now, sure, it wasn't that long ago that blackface was part of their resume if you were a singer or a dancer. 20th century brought shame, I guess, and by 1964, people cared a lot about racism, even white people. I was certainly thrown for a loop, and Olivier was hamming it up, rolling his eyes, pitching his voice low like a parody of a racist idea of a black person in blank verse. And the play itself had every racist trope of the time presented as the cause of the tragedy. It wouldn't have happened if Othello hadn't been so gullible and jealous. You know how those Moors are. But it struck me as bizarre, and why not have, you know, a black person play this black person? Anyway, I read up on blackface. Minstrel shows were the number one American live entertainment for over 100 years. 100 years! It's the weirdest damn thing, because it sent a mixed message. We wish to represent black people in our entertainment, but we want black people to play them. Black people could play nurturing maids or scaredy cat limo drivers, and that's it. And it was music and dancing that minstrel shows paid tribute to, areas where black people often excel, perhaps because black people were allowed to sing and dance, well, for each other. Then we'd eavesdrop and steal what they were doing and then whiten it up a bit so the blue notes go away and melisma goes away and sexy subject matter goes away. Don't let them do it. They'll get everybody worked up with those sexy talent moves. To be on the safe side, you get Stephen Foster to write songs full of doo-dah, doo-dah, and next thing you know, tap-dancing white people in blackface were packing up banjos and ruining show business for 100 years. 100 years! A sizable number of blackface performers were themselves black. So black people had to pretend to be white people or pretend to be black people in order to work. Today, of course, many black people have hacked out a place in the pantheon, Martin Luther King, Sammy Davis Jr., Lead Belly, ripped off, murdered, yet made famous in compensation, and back to Shakespeare. In Henry V, the French king, Charles VI, does not make an appearance. Cheated out of his place in the pantheon, you might say. Well, the real Charles VI was delusional. He believed he was made of glass, which made one-on-one encounters problematic. Probably why he wasn't in Shakespeare's play. He could shatter. You could see right through him. He might cut you. Shakespeare was good with fools, but not glass kings. Well, that's more of a 20th century spin on history, isn't it? Maybe Brecht or Pirandello or Ionesco or Alfred Jarry. Oh, wait, who are they again? Somebody check the pantheon. Glass is in the pantheon if it's stained. History if there's a propaganda value, but it's leaking playwrights like a sieve. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KLW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2024.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. Senior producer is Delvin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dan Brandon is the technical director.
Special thanks to Merle Kessler, Becky Barron, Pedro Jimenez, Karen Ajluni, and Linda Fagan.
Thanks also to Roland Green, Eric Ortiz, Bob Cable, Patricia Terrazas, and the staff here at the Stanford Community Center, which has generally sponsored tonight's event.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, and from our subscribers to our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed
or misexpressed
on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford or of our other funders.
Not even when they're totally true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a subscriber and question nearly everything. And question everything in our episode of nearly 600 episodes. I'm Ray Briggs.
And I'm Adrian Dobb. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.